Welcome back to Woods and Water, South Carolina. You know, this is Thanksgiving Saturday, and it's traditionally here on the show, I've done a memory show. I mean, Jordan's been on with me. My brother Paul's been on me. Last year, Mom came on, and we talked about growing up in the country, which is really cool. Everybody has a start in the outdoors. And if you're listening to this, you can recall your start just as vividly as I can. You know, I started out fishing with my granddaddy mitts, essentially just 250 yards from where I'm sitting right now on a little pond here in Chester that's, you know, I still get to fish it today. And the hunting side is a little fuzzier simply because I don't remember a pivotal moment. You know, we didn't have deer back then, so I can remember Paul killing his first squirrel. My Mom was with us when we did it. I can remember my first deer pretty vividly, but that wasn't until the 80s. But my start in hunting was quail, you know? That's just where it was, and it was all due to a neighbor who is still a neighbor today. He's been on the show before. It's Ken Fleming. Ken, thanks for taking a little bit of your time and being with me today. You know, we were sitting here talking, and neither one of us can really remember. I mean, I remember the story of Dad's, you know, look, I got two boys. I think they want to be in the outdoors. If anybody in the community wants to take them hunting or fishing, please do, you know, and stuff like that. And I think we're into the first child, second child syndrome, because you can remember, we were just talking about, you made Paul was crawling underneath the fence, learning how to, you know, cross the fence with a shotgun. That's my start, you've got a start too, and yours is pretty cool because your dad, like mine, didn't hunt. I mean, Mr. James, you know, hardworking man. That's what he did. He enjoyed his cows. I can remember, man. He loved those cows. He loved his Red Man chewing tobacco, you know. But he didn't hunt. So how'd you get your start?
Female, and his wife's name was Lucille, and so I named her Lou. And that was my first dog, and I was 12 years old. My dad wouldn't have a gun until I was 14, so I had a dog 2 years before I had a gun. And like I said, he would get off at 2 o'clock. I'd get home from school about 2:30, 3 o'clock, and I would follow in behind him. He would drop orange peels. He'd eat oranges, and he would drop his orange peels, and I'd get on the trail with orange peels and catch up with him, and he trained me and the dog.
At the same time.
At the same time. And that dog lived to be 14 years old. You know, we grew up together.
Sure.
I had it from the time I was 12 to the time I was
26. Yeah.
That were yours.
I mean, you named them, you hunted them, you field tried them, or whatever else. That's not counting the litters of puppies you've had sold off or dogs you've trained. Those are just yours.
Yeah, that was just dogs that I had myself. You know, sometimes I would have multiple dogs. Like right now, I've got 7. But you know, when I had my best dogs, it's when I had 2 or 3.
Okay.
Dogs and stuff, but they're not the dogs that I had in my younger days when we had wild birds.
Sure.
That's a factor too.
Yeah, that's always a factor. And these dogs you got today, I just can't believe I'm saying this, they don't have tails.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, when I started bird hunting with you, it was drilled into me that a good bird dog had a tail. I mean, whether it was the pointer tail or the English setter tail, I mean, and I can remember the first Brittany you had, you know, that little bobtail and all. I started thinking, I said, what is this deal with the no tail stuff? But German short hairs, no tails.
Yeah, you know, things evolve. Like I said, yeah, I've had pointers, setters, Brittany's, and one Irish setter.
Yeah.
And now I've got GSP. It's what's currently popular, and with the, diminished hunting areas and stuff, you can go for a shorter range and dog.
Okay.
There's a place for all of them.
Yeah.
You know, I still love those big running pointers and setters, but, you know, there's just not a lot of places that you can utilize.
Sure.
I still go to field trials, horseback field trials and walking field trials and stuff. And I love to see those dogs hit the edge and run. Takes your breath away.
Oh, it does.
But, you know, just not that many places anymore that you can do that.
Yeah. And speaking of the horseback trials, I mean, we got the, down in the Sand Hills, you got Cooper Black, which is a huge field trial area now for the horseback crowd. I remember going down there with you a couple of times. In fact, I remember one of you, the horse I was riding, Red, he got impatient. He laid down on me. Horseman.
I have fallen off about every horse I've ever rode. I've only been thrown twice. I have fallen off.
Yeah. But that is a different experience. Being in a gallery on horseback, watching those dogs, like you said, hit that edge, and they run that edge and may, you know, half mile out. And they run all the way back to you, and then they just start that crisscross working into the wind and all. It's a really unique experience. Yeah.
Now that there's not as many places to go and wild bird hunting, the field trials,
right,
walking and horseback, have kind of taken the place of wild bird hunting for the people that still, you know, want to have a dog and get out there and do it.
And for the last 2 weeks, well, I guess 3 weeks ago, and then this past weekend when I've been over here deer hunting, you've had hunt tests going on for those field trials, and got a Nastra field trial coming here the first Saturday and Sunday in December.
That's right. We had a 2-day hunt test, an AKC hunt test, here at the farm last weekend, and we had about 50 dogs, 50 participants, and, you know, that's kind of put and take hunting. You know, we put out the birds, and two dogs, you know, run together, and they've got 30 minutes to find his window. Birds that get scored on, the point, back, the tree, the style. And, you know, it's not hunting, but it's still dogs. And,
still being outside, carrying a gun, smelling some gun smoke, friendships. I mean, that's a real important thing in hunting, always has been. I was collecting my deer down there near your pond, and y'all were putting out birds, and I thought you'd seen me, and we were right there within 50 yards of each other, and you were concentrating on your thing, and I was concentrating on mine, and I said, I'll catch up to him later. But it's a fun time. I was involved with it back when Nastra was big and all, and I had a couple of setters, ran them in a couple of trials, and it was fun. I just didn't have the time for it. It was the wrong time of the year for me.
Yeah, it's time consuming. We have trials here in Chester, and they have national trials over in Seneca. We have a couple of horseback trials. There's one going on in Camden this weekend. There's one last weekend. Then we have a couple scheduled for the first of the year at Cooper Black.
Okay. So if you're interested in this, there are opportunities for you to get involved, go look, watch, and see if it's for you. And I think, you know, GSPs, there's a lot of them out there. I think they make just good pets. I mean, my setters, good gosh, they just so much energy and all that, it's hard to keep one of those in the house around kids and stuff like that. From what I see, the German Shorthairs are good family dogs.
They really are. And, you know, the Shorthair won the Westminster Dog Show a couple of years ago, and that really increased their popularity. And that's really just what's going now. They moved up from like 49th.
Most popular list or whatever. Yeah.
To about 16.
Oh, wow. Right. Eclipse that. They're just such good dogs. But if you want to get into the field trial, and a German Shorthair is the way to go, I think.
Yeah, this day and time. But like I said, it's a place for all.
Yeah. What was the one that we had like the mustache and the goatee? You had our hair. Yeah. He was something.
Yeah, they're really tough dogs. And, you know, we still have a good many of them run in the AKC test and in NAVDA. There's a place for all of them.
Yeah, yeah. And you've had all of them. That's the cool thing growing up over here and getting to tag along with you. Like I said, it's probably somewhere mid to late 70s. You know, you started out with Paul, and I guess I just kind of fell in when Paul fell off the cart, so to speak. And I can remember, oh man, so many of your dogs, Missy and Frank, Jake, all different breeds and all. And you know, in some respects, you have to be a dog person to bird hunt. You have to be a dog person to duck hunt. I mean, if you're really into it, it's not so much the birds, it's the dog, because the dog's always with you. You may not find a bird, you may not find a duck, but that dog is always with you. He's always in the kennel out back, he's in on your couch when you come home. Always, and it's that bond, you and the dog. And I've often heard it said the greatest injustice in life is that a dog doesn't live as long as his master. On the flip side, you get to enjoy so many different dogs. It's just a tough part when one goes away, and then you start the process all over with another one.
Start them off dragging a bird wing, you know, a fishing pole, and see that little puppy point that bird wing, that foot up, head up, tail up.
And, you know, it's just there. You just gotta, like I said, you gotta make sure. And they get tired. I mean, they'll chase it for the first 20 times you put it out there. They'll chase it until they're just worn out. And when they get worn out, that's when that first pause happens, and it's magical.
Yep, you just see that natural instinct.
There it is. There it is. Yeah.
Like his ancestors did, and we try to, you know, train it to hunt for us.
Yeah.
It's our bird.
Our bird. And that's sometimes a tough thing to do, because a lot of those dogs are strong willed.
Yeah.
And it's their bird. They work for it as their bird, and you may get what's left of it.
Yeah. But, you know, we don't have any kids, and people have often questioned that. And I said, well, you know, no better than I did with dogs. The dog wants to do, you know, what you want.
Right. Yeah.
I knew that if I had a strong little kid, I wouldn't have been as successful as I had been with the dog.
Well, you did a pretty good job with me. I would put that feather in your hat, because I, you know, growing up over here, you're kind of always the moderating influence on my hunting, because I can remember several times. Well, one time we were birding. You told me, you said, man, I saw a big deer over here across the creek and all. And we were bird hunting not a few weeks later, and I'd slipped a couple slugs in my jacket. And you were working for the department. I mean, you were a wildlife conservation officer at the time with DNR. And you said, well, now we're running deer with dogs. And it was those little things like that that just kind of kept me on the straight and narrow. During those years, I probably would have, you know, in those times when I was by myself and nobody was watching, your ethics, you know, there's nobody to question or anything, it kind of kept me straight because of the example that you set for me.
Yeah, said, I was the conservation officer in the late 70s, early 80s here, and really enjoyed it. And then later in my career, I left there and went into private security to make more money because I was getting married. But I came back and worked on the management side with DNR. And, you know, it's just wildlife has always been real important in my life.
Oh, yeah.
Bird hunting and just wildlife management and stuff has always been really important.
You know, we had that little thing, and I immediately felt bad. I'm like, gosh, I didn't know any different, you know. But I remember there was, and we'll get to some of these other, but one of the best memories I have, and I still remember it today, on and off, usually around the opening day of dove season. I was 16. First year, you got to have your hunting license. And traditionally, in growing up with us, besides opening day of quail season come Thanksgiving, was opening day of dove season, Labor Day. And I can remember being down on dirt road down here, not too far from where we're sitting right now, and opening day. And I think it was kind of drizzling rain just a little bit, I think. Cloudy, I think it was drizzling rain. And we were up there, and I see a green truck come around the curve and had a DNR logo on the door. And I was like, oh, good, I get to show off my hunting license. Only problem was I didn't have my hunting license. So go ahead. Tell everybody what you did to me that day.
Well, yeah, I knew that I'd raised you right. I knew that you had your hunting license. So I, you know, me and my supervisor walked down there, and I said, okay, I need to see your hunting license. All it is, you all red-faced and shuddering and carrying on. I said, we can't go to
haul me off to jail.
Part of being a good conservation officer is also being a good PR man and putting a 16-year-old kid or writing a 16-year-old kid a ticket on his first hunt was not a good PR.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'd rather give somebody a break and make a lifetime hunter than make a lifetime enemy.
Yeah. You did make me go home and get it, though. I had to stop right there. You waited on me. Paul to come back over here. I got my license, came back, you checked it, and I was good to go. But that's one of those memories. I mean, I'm sure some of you listening out here have the same memories, something just like that from a family member or something, and you understand what I'm talking about. But those memories just live with you forever. But that was one of those things, buddy. I tell you what, I leave the house now. I check two or three times to make sure I got licenses, tags, whatever I've got to have. That's the last thing I check before I head out the door.
That's good.
One lesson learned. You know, we're sitting right here at the kitchen table. We've sat here for, I don't know, my entire life and spent a lot of time at the kitchen table at your mom and dad's house right across a couple of barbed wire fences over here. You know, growing up, it was quail hunting. How many miles do you think we have walked over the years that way, over here, across the road, behind the church? You know, it's incalculable.
It sure is. You know, I wish I could walk it again today like I did then. You know, not much on technology, but I would have loved to have one of
the Fitbits. Fitbits, yeah. Right.
And some days, you know, I would walk 3 or 4 miles.
And that was just in a few hours.
Yeah.
That wasn't counting those days where we would drive off to MacBe or somewhere and hunt all day.
Yeah.
Dark. It was, you know, we walked a lot, but there were a lot of birds back then.
That's right. Right here, I can remember having 9 coveys of birds on this side of the road and 8 coveys of birds across the road. And you know, you could kind of pick the scent of them on any given day, afternoon or Saturday morning or whatever. If I picked the scent of those birds,
Yeah. Right here. Yep. It was open to you. Ask you, you know, did you find any birds today? Did you have any luck? You know, what's it look like this year? You know, I remember there was a covey that lived right here below the garden spot. I don't know what kind of bush that was. It was just one little corner down there had that. It was almost like an ornamental. It was like a shrub you had, and those birds just loved being in that stuff because it was real thick and grew. The head of the pond had another covey. The kudzu patch on the other side had a covey. Had a covey over here at the graveyard, cemetery at the church. And I remember hunting over there one day, and you were letting me use your Beretta. You had a Beretta A303 that I just worshipped. And I remember killing a bird over there, and I just, like, I'm in heaven. That was a cool covey over there.
Yeah, it was. You know, and that's the thing. You know, we can go back and remember those coveys, the kudzu covey.
Yeah.
Now there's a brick house.
There's a brick house there.
Yeah. We will have a name. I can tell you where I found, you know, the watermelon patch bird, cottonfield bird, or whatever, and you would know where I was talking
yep.
about.
That's right. But it wasn't just here. I mean, you traveled to Texas bird hunting. You used to go to Kansas some. So you've experienced it all over. Does that experience is off? Does it compare to what you had here at home?
Well, still exciting. It really is. But now, home's where the heart is.
Yeah. Sure. That's right. Yeah. Because those birds are really your friends.
That's right.
You know, you never, I don't think you ever let us shoot more than a couple on a covey rise. I can't remember. Do we ever hunt singles?
Very seldom. You know, unless, you know, it was a real big covey, it was early in the year, you know, we might kill a single or two, but pretty much we just hunt the coveys and then go on to the next covey because there's more time to use.
Yeah. But we were also managing the birds, too.
That's right. If we ever got down below six birds, you know, everybody would quit shooting. You know, we weren't the only people utilizing these resources.
Right.
We had others, like my uncle, he was still up.
Right.
And we would hunt the same coveys. But once the covey got down to six birds, you quit shooting. You might let the dogs work them, but you didn't shoot them. And then let you succeed for the next year.
You know, and it was a lot easier. I mean, we're sitting here now. There's a, you know, there's cotton fields right across the road. I mean, that's been cotton and soybeans and milo ever since I was a kid. I mean, I can remember crop dusters working that field right over there. But that's a totally different cotton field than it was 40 years ago. Buck. Yeah.
Then when it's fall harvest time, they spray it to make the bowls open, they spray it to make the leaves fall off to where it's more efficient for the pickers to come in and pick it. The machines and stuff are so much more efficient today. You know, back in the 70s when we were hunting and had birds, Most of the farmers around here were planting corn and sorghum and soybeans and some cotton. And like I said, they were aerial spreaders.
Sure.
Just for the bug.
Right.
But you had a lot of weeds. You had a lot more weeds and all the crops and stuff. And the old combines weren't near as efficient. They left a lot of waste grain on the field. They couldn't get into the corners and stuff. They weren't four-wheel drive combines, so if you had a little wet spot in the field.
Went around it. Yeah. Right.
So you wrecked the stubble and the weeds and stuff for the winter, and that had a real good habitat for the birds.
You know, I don't guess we'll ever have the birds back like we had them. I mean, you and I were both around this area when York County bought Draper. And, you know, Draper, it's a beautiful place. I mean, people come all over to take pictures of sunflowers. There were pictures all over Facebook of the sunflowers at Draper this year. Beautiful place. Great place to go. Look, go up there, dove hunt. You got ponds you can fish at and all. When they bought that, though, I remember Quail Unlimited was big. You and I are both in Three Rivers chapter over here. And, you know, we set about with Quail Unlimited in York County and DNR putting that back to quail habitat, essentially. Small game, really, I guess. Okay.
The premier spot for bird hunting in the upstate. Red Center, of course, down in the low country, the premier spot in South Carolina for years. And when we got Draper in 1995, the fellow, Dave Draper, that had owned it, was an IBM executive, and he had it as a cattle farm, but he had one section off at the first license shooting reserve. In this area, one of the first license shooting reserves in this area, and I've got one of the signs.
Oh, wow.
And after the state took it over, we found one of the signs back there on a tree, and I got that sign. But when we took it over in 95, we did a quail survey, and we determined we had 15 coveys, viable coveys of birds on that property.
And how many acres?
850 acres. And today, the last survey that I participated in up there, which has been 3 years ago now, we heard four coveys of birds. And, everybody's got a theory on what happened to the birds, but nobody's got,
the fix.
Rescue, pine trees, coastal, no seeds or anything on any of that. Back when we were hunting, the pastures weren't nearly as clean.
Oh, no. briar patches and fence rows were covered with honeysuckle and red cedar and, wild plum trees and you could run on with what made up a hedgerow in this area in the 70s and 80s.
And all of that was good for the birds. And they had all the tenant farmers, and they had yard chickens and stuff, but they were real vigilant about keeping the prairies out. The chicken snakes and chicken hawks,
yeah.
And possums and coons and stuff. Once we lost those tenant farmers and lost the trappers, fur bearing prices went out, and people quit trapping. It got politically incorrect to trap. And it's got so many nest breakers and stuff out there today that we didn't have back then.
Every once in a while, I hear some covey, and I ran a covey here this past January, right down here at the bottom of the hill where the old persimmon tree used to be. I've heard a few whistles around. I know you got some callback boxes over here, but I've heard some few whistles. Are those birds that are just looking? Are those birds that have wandered off from field trials? Do you think there's remnants of a covey somewhere around here?
I'd like to think there's still remnants of a covey somewhere around here. This is the first year that I've not seen a wild bird. We hear birds in the spring whistling and trying to get together during the mating season and stuff. And I heard them again this year. But In the last couple of years, I've been able to find one covey every year, maybe 4 to 6 birds at its peak.
Right.
You know, right after they hatch out and you see what, you know, it's 80% of yearly mortality. You know,
right.
80% of them are going to die.
One way or the other.
One way or the other. Not just due to hunting, just due to natural predation, weather, and things like that. 80% mortality rate. But this year, you know, I heard the birds in the spring, and I have not seen a wild bird this year. That's the first time. Where I said we used to be able to find 16, 17 covies. Today, I don't know where there's a bird. We're out there going to put you in a wild bird.
Man, that's sobering. And I don't know that we'll ever be able to bring them back. I mean, the farming practices are here to stay. There's fewer of the farming going on. A lot more fescue. I mean, we're sitting here, and I've got 20-something acres of pine trees out here that, you know, I wish had never been planted. But, look, it was a decision was made, you know, and you got to go with it. You know, there's you know, the South Carolina Bobwhite Initiative. QU is back in a form with Quail Forever. I mean, I guess the same intent and all. And there are focus areas here in South Carolina. There's one right over here in Lancaster. MACB is one. Where does the future of bird hunting go? I mean, you know, you got the field trialers, but none of them hunt because of the lack of birds. It takes money to do all this. I mean, to get a dog, to keep it up, to drive, to train, and is there a future for bird hunting?
I certainly hope so. Hope springs eternal. I've been to the Bobwhite Initiative meetings and stuff. I've got some good ideas, some good programs and stuff. You know, it takes money, it takes time. I hope we've got enough time and we can recruit enough money, you know, with corporate sponsors and stuff to. Well,
what's that going to do? I mean, are you releasing birds? Are you hoping that the coveys you have, given the habitat and the food and all, that they'll, you know, split coveys and now you have two where there was one? Or how does that happen that you repopulate? Right.
Kind of I hope it isn't too late. You know, I'm not real big into genetics and stuff, but I know you've got to have, you know, 1 + 1 to have or equal 2.
Right.
Or to make a gain. You've got to have something there to start with. You can't have, you know, 0 + 1, it doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, all the memories we've got together, all of, you know, all the dogs that we walked behind, times, stuff we talked about and all. I remember towards the end, when I had Bell in trouble, and then, you know, you taught me how to, you know, I raised those puppies and taught them how to point back and all. Even did a little guiding with them. Thanks to you, I carried a five-year-old kid around on my shoulder for most of the day on one of those hunts. You know, I was going to get rid of them because, you know, lack of birds. I'm an accountant. Bird season, the better part of bird season is, you know, January, February, March, when everybody else is out of the woods. You don't have to deal with the deer hunters or anybody else. You know, we went over to MACB, Sand Hills, which to me just took forever. Every time we went over there, it just seemed to take forever. It was like 3 hours or something like that. But you and I, we hunted hard that day. It was, seemed like there was somebody else with us. Who would have gone with us? Clark. That's right. Clark was with us. And, you know, we found that covey out on the side of the hill late in the day. And they rose, and I think each of us killed one on the rise. And then there was a lay bird, and a bird just kind of stayed, held until we quit. And he kept, went around the other side, and I turned around and I shot him. And I, you know, it was just, it was, that swing is etched in my memory. But what was even more was I almost felt guilty about shooting that second bird. You know, I knew there weren't many of them, but it was like, this is my last hurrah with my bird dogs until at some point down the road I can, you know, find a way to get some more or have a reason to get some more. I mean, any regrets like that in yours?
Sure. You know, a couple of years ago, I had a fellow invite me to a bird hunt. He said he had four or five coveys on his property, and we went and found the first covey and killed two birds out of the covey. We hunted the rest of the day and didn't find another bird. And he kept telling me we were seeing them. It was all kind of in a circular pattern, that same covey of birds.
Okay.
From the center out. We only had one covey of birds, and we've taken a third of it. So I regret that. And the last time I went to Texas, out there on a big ranch where they said they had 100 coveys of birds that we could find.
Yeah.
From the first covey of birds, the dog pointed. I had wild birds in it a couple of years. It was excited. I walked up there and picked the birds up. It was probably 25 to 35 bird cutting, and I killed three birds on the ride.
Wow.
Got excited. As soon as that third shot went off and that bird failed, I thought about, here I am again. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
That was pretty. And the landowner or the leasee came up to me and I said, I'm sorry about that. I shouldn't have done that. He said, oh no. He said, we ain't fed that cubby all year. He said, it's probably 30 birds. He ain't done it. Real hard to that. But it, you know, makes you think. I don't know that I ever killed a limit of wild birds. You know, the limit was always pretty liberal. You know,
12 birds or something like that?
12 birds.
Yep.
Yeah. You couldn't possibly find 12 birds, you know, in South Carolina to kill in one day.
You kind of took what you could use.
That's right.
Always knowing that, you know, what I take today, I won't be able to take tomorrow. I have to wait till next year. Type thing. It's the same thing with everything. I mean, you know, we just implemented a tag system with deer. People are going out of this world because you can only kill 17 deer in South Carolina. Well, where we're sitting now, you can only kill 10. And I can't eat but three, you know? So you got to, and I wonder, you know, Paul and I have talked about this a lot, about the mindset of today's hunters as opposed to what, you know, the mindset I grew up with and you grew up with. And a limit's there to protect the resource as much as it is protect you. And you only took what you could use. You always watched that. Like you said, once it got down to 8 birds, you left it alone because that was next year's seed.
And, you know, to me, it was all about the dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Dogs, you had a lot of dogs. What best dog? Okay. You've always had a lot of good dogs. I mean, I remember Waldo. I mean, Waldo was your quintessential family dog. He hung around the front yard. He ate well. I mean, he didn't eat dog food. He ate table scraps. Every Sunday morning, Waldo walked to church. Every Sunday. He waited till church was over. He walked home. You know, first bird dog I remember was Lou and some of the others and all. Best bird dog you ever had?
Was probably a little pointer named Becky. We're living in White.
I remember Becky, yeah. Yes. She was small.
Yeah, she was a real small dog.
Yep.
And it didn't last 6 years, died early, but she was probably one of the best dogs, or possibly the best dog I ever had. I paid $20 for it. Farmer up the road had a litter of pups. I bought the pup for $20. He gave me a guarantee. He said, if it didn't make a bird dog, he'd give me my money back. At 6 months old, I ran that dog in a derby competition, which was 24 months of age. The dog was 24 to 36 months. I ran her at six
Yeah.
And she placed second in the field trial. And I ran into him. He asked me about the dog. And I can't believe you took my money.
Oh man, best dog. What is there one dog that just maybe wasn't the best dog, but you just liked it more than any of the others? I mean, we find things to like about every dog we got. Right.
Yeah, you always remember your first. Becky was the first dog when we got married. You know, my wife helped me train her.
Yeah.
So that was special.
Yeah.
We've got a short hair now that was our first short hair. And she is.
Is that Bailey?
Yeah, Bailey. And, you know, she's the mother of most of our puppies and stuff. She's retired now. She's 8 years old. She retired from breeding.
Yeah.
She's special. She's definitely special. Like I said before, it's just a place for all.
Yeah. Well, man, I really appreciate you doing this for me. It's, you know, coming back over here and being able to come back over, you know, I gotta, it's Thanksgiving. I gotta thank my parents. You know, they hung onto this place, you know, for, wow, what, since 1965? I mean, we haven't lived over here since 78. They hung onto this place. It's always been a place I could come back to and just kind of, you know, even now I can drive, I can leave Greenville, and by the time I hit Spartanburg, I start feeling a little better. You know, come out the other side of the gas stations there at Croft and hit number, you know, hit the road in and get on number 9. And by the time I cross the bridge in Lockhart, I'm like, yeah, this is going to be fun. I always go over here and relax and get rid of all the stress and all. A lot of memories over here, a lot of good ones. And it's kind of always been home, just like it's your home. You know, yours is right across the fence right here. Yeah.
It's such a special place. We've got to be thankful for all of our resources.
Yeah.
And blessings that we've received.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And mom and dad gave us this place. And your mom and dad, I mean, I remember Miss Sarah. Well, your dad, he loved his Red Man chewing tobacco. And he was always giving me the little orange vest that came in the packages.
Yeah, that was one of the first safety features around was the Red Man, including those little vinyl orange.
For the deer hunters. And I had a bunch of them. Because, buddy, let me tell you what, the first bride that got a hold of it, it ripped it from side to side.
Yeah, like I said, modern technology has come a long way.
And then Miss Sarah, I remember, okay, how many thousands of bales of hay have we cut, baled, and hauled, and thrown, and, you know, one of the funny, and this will be the last little bit, one of the funniest things I can remember, it's totally aside from hunting and all, but back to your mom. Yeah, every time you sat down at her table, she might have said it was leftovers, but there was green beans, there was black-eyed peas, there was usually rice and gravy, cube steak. I mean, this was just like Tuesday lunchtime. So I remember Miss Sarah and her food. Oh, man, it was great. She'd sit out on the front porch, and just I'd walk right here across the fence, walk up that other fence line, and you might not have been around, but I'd sit there and talk to her, talk to Mr. James. Just good people. She cook it. That's exactly right. Got to end this in a minute, but one of the best memories outside of hunting I got, we baled a bunch of hay. And you had the old red farm truck. I guess it was red. It was that rust or was that paint. I don't know. But anyway, I had a big old flatbed on it. And at the time, I was living over here with Debbie. We'd gotten married and moved over here. And we had a Labrador retriever named Allie. And we were throwing hay one day. And the red farm truck, you could put it in first gear. And it would just kind of chug along. Just perfect pace for you to walk beside, throw bales and all that. Well, Allian, was it? What was the dog?
I think it was Spot.
They were in the cab of the truck. I can still remember looking over there, and Allie's in the passenger seat looking at me. Spot's behind the wheel, and it looks like the dogs are driving the hay truck for us.
Some of your best out.
Didn't complain when the hay got down the back of their neck and their shirt started itching. Some great times. Great times. Well, thanks for doing this for me. I have never regretted a minute of time I've been around you. I hope I haven't disappointed you in anything I've done, because you've had a lot to do with where I am today. And Woods and Water, South Carolina, wouldn't be around if it weren't for you.
No, I'm really proud that you carried on the heritage with the program. It's something I know you always wanted to do. And I'm thrilled that maybe I had a little part.
You did. We're about to get weepy here, so we'll end it on that. But listen, this Thanksgiving, be thankful for what you got. I know everybody's so busy. Everybody's got a lot going on. But this is a time to stop. Think back on your life. Find something or somebody you can be thankful for and let them know. Because if you never let them know, they never know what kind of influence they've had on your life. So thanks for being here from Woods and Water, South Carolina, as always. Hope you tune in again next week. As always, make time to get out there, because time's not coming back around. Take the back roads when you can, because that's where South Carolina comes alive. And don't forget your camera. See you back here next week.